Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Greg Kaplan, author of The Journey, How to Prepare Kids for a Competitive and Changing World, focuses on equipping parents and students with the tools and mindset necessary to navigate the competitive landscape of college admissions and preparation for a successful life. He highlights three key traits, grit, leadership, and passion, as essential for thriving in college, the workplace, and adulthood. Kaplan wishes parents would stop thinking, what should I do to get my kid in a good college, and ask instead, how do I best prepare my child for what comes next? Greg Kaplan is an internationally recognized college admission strategist. His firm, the Kaplan Education Group, helps hundreds of high school students and underclassmen reach their educational and career potential each year. Greg Kaplan, welcome to 411 Teen. Thanks so much for your participating.
Thank you so much for having me today, Liz. It's an honor to be here.
What inspired you to write this book?
The way I like to think about this book is that it was the follow-up to my first book, which was called Earning Admission, Real Strategies for Getting Kids into Highly Selective Colleges. And that launched me down a path of working one-on-one with students to reach their potential through their education and with an eye towards what happens after college. And since I published that book in 2016, I've worked with thousands of students. And I began to notice certain behavior patterns where we were so focused on getting into, you know, insert name brand university here or there at the expense of their growth. Or I'd have students or families, I should say, who would keep their kids at sports practices for 6-7 hours a day and then complain about burnout. Or ones that would, I actually just had a family in my office earlier today that was contemplating moving to a different part of California for their kid to attend a, quote, more prestigious high school. And so these are the types of things that I've been observing. And I wanted to call attention to them and have a larger conversation about being healthy about the journey to college and making sure that young people are actually prepared for the incredible world that awaits them, so long as they're being mindful of it. So this was, I guess, the follow-up to that and trying to insert some sanity and some realness, authenticity into a process that has evolved in some good ways and some less than ideal ways.
So who was your book intended for? Because I could see it being beneficial for several populations, parents, even, you know, counselors, students.
I write the book in an unusual way in that the chapters alternate. So the book is broken up into three parts that talk about grit, that talk about leadership, and talk about passion. And the chapters alternate, with one chapter being written to the parents, mm-hmm. one chapter being written to the students, because I think the journey to college and career, and it doesn't even necessarily have to involve college, is a team sport. And we need to make sure that families are aligned to make sure that young people emerge from high school as adults, healthy, happy, and on the path to financial independence. I do think it takes a village to raise a child today, and this book is just as much intended for that village as it is for the parents and children, but it is the primary audience are the students and their families.
Okay. So often, parents are focused on getting their child into that good school, as you just recommended, as you just said, that one of the parents was considering moving. But why do you recommend a shift in parental thinking from getting into that good school to preparing the child for what comes next? Because they see getting into that good school as the ultimate, Because once they do that, everything else will be okay.
I think this is a little bit of antiquated thinking that you have to go to a certain school to achieve your goals. And I think in an era of 5% acceptance rates and $400,000 price tags, we need to be very honest about the fact that where one goes to school is not who they will become. And they're, you know, the Ivy League universities routinely reject 99% of high school valedictorians, reject 99% of applicants with perfect SAT or ACT college entrance exam scores. And so we need to have a healthy mindset because there are just simply too many people applying to these very sought after schools. And we need to make sure that young people feel empowered to achieve their goals, regardless of their educational paths. And we need to make sure there's so much student loans out there today, and it is becoming such a hindrance for my generation as a millennial and for Gen Zers to achieve their goals, that we need to make sure that young people understand how education allows them to achieve their goals and not make this process work the other way around. And so I just think that in the last 20 years, the obsession with college admission has sometimes handicapped young people to actually achieving what they'd like to do. And that's why I think it's so important to have this conversation.
In the context of education and career development, how do you define success?
I would say in the context of long-term career development, success to me, if you one is applying to college, is that they end up enrolling at a university that makes financial sense for them and their family, i.e. that they won't be saddled with astronomical student loans that prevent them from pursuing their dreams. And I also think it's that they end up having a sense of direction and purpose. It's normal for an 18-year-old going to university to not know what they want to do for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
But if they have a general inclination, i.e., I'm interested in potentially working with other people or helping people. Mm. And I know, say, that may be becoming a mental health professional, becoming a nurse or a social worker, or I enjoy history and logic and I'm going to potentially consider a career in the law, or I like building things and I'm going to consider being an engineer or going the trades route. I think having an understanding of oneself and making sure that high school allows for that self-discovery, to me, is success. What is not included in the definition of success is the name of the university. I think it's wonderful to get to go to school, say Duke or a flagship state university like, you know, the University of Florida, but it doesn't necessarily run through those schools alone.
Okay. You talk about grit, and grit is one of the key traits that you emphasize. Why is grit so important or so crucial for young people and just for the listening audience, so we're all on the same page? What is grit? What is it composed of? What are we talking about when we refer to grit?
I think grit will mean different things to different people, but the way I define it in the book is the ability to deal with life's day-to-day challenges. And I think this is so important in an era where mom and dad are often known for fighting their children's battles.
Yes.
Yeah. This kid, and I refer to these parents in the book, and I was raised by hover parents. I think wherever, as a child, I always saw, my parents were always there, always in close tow. But there's a new type of parent out there today, and that is called a snowplow parent. And a snowplow parent is the type that literally removes every obstacle from their child's path, so they achieve things that they may not otherwise be able to achieve. And when a snowplow parent takes over for the child, they lose the ability to actually overcome these obstacles by themselves. And so when there are statistics out there that 10% of millennials, and keep in mind, millennials are now approaching 41 years of age at the high end, 10% of millennials have reported having mom or dad address a work problem with their boss. That is not a recipe for success. And we have to ask ourselves, what is leading to these conditions? And it's a lack of grit. It comes with, if mom and dad are doing the child's homework because they don't have the wherewithal to sit there and do it themselves, can we honestly expect them to hold down a 9-to-5 job? Probably not. And so we need to actually take stock of that and ask ourselves, are we winning the short-term battle, but losing sight of the forest through the trees? And I think there's a lot of that mm-hmm. going on today in society.
How did parents evolve to this? They weren't always like that. When I was in school, they certainly weren't.
You know, it's so funny you ask that question, because the stuff we see at, in my practice, and we work with about 1,500 families a year, we were like, is this happening or is this a dream?
Mm-hmm.
Is it fever dream? I think it's out of concern, because I think life is a lot more competitive today. I think when you have 5% acceptance rates for getting into public universities in places like the University of California, or, you know, in Florida, the University of Florida and Florida State have become quite selective. I think there's a fear that young people are going to get left behind, and this also extends to their careers. And so I think we're so concerned that young people are going to get left behind that we may lose sight of the fact that you know, if they don't learn to fight their own battles and develop the skills to persevere, that they will be left behind mm-hmm. at an age mm-hmm. where it's much harder to course correct. So it comes from a good place, but it ultimately handicaps people in a far more pervasive way.
Well, we know about good intentions, okay? So
what do they say about it? The path to hell is paved with them?
Yeah.
You know all about it. That's what my Spanish professor...
That's what I was referring to. I was thinking, yeah, I know the intentions are good, but if you don't know how to stand up for yourself, and parents are not always going to be there, you are going to encounter situations and people that you're going to have to make a decision. You're going to have to act on it. You don't have the opportunity to consult mom or dad to have them come in and snowplow the avenue so you can get on down this road. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know, that this doesn't, I'm old school, but that doesn't sit well with me. I mean, it's like you are not teaching your children anything. You know, they have to learn how to live and exist in today's world, whether it's in an academic circle, whether it's in a job market circle, or, you know, whatever. But it's that we're going to take a brief break, and I want to come back and we can talk about some ways that parents can help their children develop grit. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Greg Kaplan, an internationally recognized college admissions strategist. Greg, we were just talking about grit, and I was wondering, would you share some practical ways with parents that can help them help their children develop grit?
Sure. I think the best way for a young person to develop grit is one of the most basic ways. And we've gotten so far away from this that I have to emphasize this with every student I meet for the first time. And that is getting a part-time job. Mm-hmm. Because if you can defuse World War III when you put the wrong milk in a latte, you will be able to deal with a difficult boss when the time comes. And let's be real. We've all had a difficult boss. Or if you're in my shoes, every boss you've ever had prior to starting your own business was a difficult boss. Mm-hmm. And so I always tell young people, the life lessons you will learn, just dealing with other people's problems, the unpleasantness, the entitlement, will prepare you for, you will learn more from that experience than probably from everything in high school put together. And I one time had a parent say to me, but my child will never need to work. And I said, that's mm-hmm. precisely why they need a part-time job, because you can never say never. And so everyone needs a part-time job in high school. And a lot of universities, particularly large public universities, that is the first thing they look for in applicants, because college dropout rates are skyrocketing. And I write about this in my book about a young person who dropped out of an amazing university because they didn't like the food served in the cafeteria.
Yes, you did. Yes.
Like, for the Lord's sake, that is not a valid reason. You have to figure out how to make that salad bar work for you. But if you haven't had that situation where you're just, there's that expectation that the world doesn't revolve around you, when are you going to learn that? And I think, and it's so common. College dropout rates are skyrocketing for roommate disagreements, for class scheduling issues. We have to get away from this.
Yeah, I'm so glad you identified those.
You know, a third of Gen Z, young Gen Z, so this is 18 to 24, a third of Gen Z in this cohort for that six-year span are neither pursuing an education, have achieved an education, or working. A third of young people ages 18 to 24 are doing nothing with their lives. And I think, you know, if some are having a break, that's fantastic. But even if it was half of that number, that is an unacceptable statistic as a society that we cannot tolerate.
Well, leadership was another fundamental trait that you discussed in your book. And what qualities make a good leader? I'm scared to even ask this in today's world, because some of the popular leaders, their qualities are questionable, but what qualities?
I'm glad you at least are willing to say it.
Yeah, well, but
courage for you.
Yeah. So what qualities do you think, you know, make a good leader?
The way we now, and I'm glad you said it, because, you know, some leaders, leadership isn't necessarily about popularity, but I think we're talking a whole other thing, Liz, and that's a topic for another day, or not for your not for to be broadcast out to the world to hear.
Right.
But when I think of young people and leadership, I define leadership as the ability, as the perspective to understand how to, and the ability to make an impact. As young people progress through the world, they will be evaluated based on the impact that they're able to make. And that could be in their careers, that could be within their communities, that can be within their own families. And so as a young person, to make an impact in high school, that typically comes through volunteering for causes that truly are meaningful and help those. And so we always tell the young students we work with and that it doesn't matter what they do. They don't need to be student body president. They don't need to be captain of the sports team, but they need to learn whatever makes them tick and what motivates them, and find a way to help others around them. So leadership can be like, with an example, it could be volunteering at a food bank and helping community members in need, and then taking it one step further and recruiting friends or classmates so there are more volunteers at that organization so they can increase the impact they make in food distribution. It could be, we had a student that in his junior year of high school survived a horrific car accident. He was inspired to bring someone who was driving recklessly, a public speaker who many years ago was driving recklessly and almost and killed someone in his car, and to just provide, you know, to fundraise to bring a speaker to his high school to encourage young people, you know, his peers, to be driving less distracted and more focused on the road. So it comes in so many different ways. It just needs to be true to that person and their gifts and make an impact in something that matters for them, because they can take that skill and then learn how to make an impact, like I said, on their first job and their second job within their communities, and life will reward them for that.
And I'm so glad that you said that and shared that, because so often we say leadership and we think we're talking about having some kind of formal title or formal position, and it's not about that at all. That could be part of it, depending on where you're sitting. But as you said, it might be starting an initiative in your community. And a lot of these students have the potential and do have the interest to do that, but I don't think that they see leadership in that way. So thanks for sharing that. Thanks for sharing those examples. And passion. Passion is that third key trait that you identified. How do you suggest students go about discovering their passions? So many don't have an idea of what they're passionate about. they have not had the opportunity, I think they haven't had the opportunity to explore and be sensitive and in tune with their environment and with themselves to know their passion.
And it's not just young people, I think, that struggle with figuring out their passion. I think we can both meet a lot of people our own ages that don't know what their passions are. And I think that word gets thrown around a lot, passion. Mm-hmm. When someone is truly passionate about what they do, it doesn't really, the effort required to reach their goals doesn't feel like a chore or a bother. That's the feeling we are chasing. There is no substitute for real world experience to go out there and find your passions. So when a young person tells me that they think they want to be a doctor, my first thought is, well, mom and dad are probably pushing that in the background, and that's okay. Is that you need to go volunteer at a hospital and you need to see if that's something that you actually are passionate about, because unless that truly comes from within, med school, residency, the amount of sacrifice that takes for such a noble calling is going to be hard to justify. And so this is me providing an example to say the only way for one to discover their passion is to get out there and explore the world. And you try again. Mm-hmm. Because if you try enough things, you will find something that eventually feels good. But we can never give up on that pursuit of finding one's passion, because it is needed. And I think that is a commitment a young person needs to make to themselves. Mm-hmm. And parents need to give their children the space and the encouragement and the support to find their passions, not the parents' passion. Mm-hmm. I went to law school to please my parents, and I'm very open about that. I think I write about that in my book. And within the first 5 minutes of my class, on the first day of class, I had my arrested development moment where I was like, oh my gosh, I have made a terrible mistake. And I sat there looking around. I was like, I'm not supposed to be here. And that law school was the equivalent for a lot of different reasons, but it was very unenjoyable and it was very unsettling, because I knew it wasn't my passion, no matter how well I was doing in it. And so I always tell young people that I would never have gone to law school had I shadowed another attorney other than my father. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so important for young people to get out there. So we really do push every young person we work with. And in my book, I really emphasize, you've got to go out there and try things, community college classes, internships, shadowing. Mm-hmm. There are so many opportunities in this information age. You don't even have to leave home to see things, for better or for worse, but we do need to try different things to make sure that we find something that actually speaks to us and us alone.
Well, one thing I find is that parents have misconceptions about the college admissions process. And would you share some of the common misconceptions that parents have about the whole college admissions process?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions that parents have is that certain schools have a monopoly on the path to success. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of students that dream of being tech entrepreneurs or working at places like Meta or Google or Amazon. And they say that they have to go to schools like Columbia or NYU or Stanford to do just that. And I always tell them that the statistics speak for themselves, that there are more graduates from San Jose State working in Silicon Valley than the entire Ivy League put together. Or that they need to go to Harvard for undergrad, so their kid can go to Harvard for law school and then end up on the Supreme Court or working at a big law firm. And then I always tell them that where one goes for undergrad isn't a factor. The prestige of an undergraduate university is not a factor for applying to grad school. So I think there's just so much of this out there that it just doesn't make sense. So I think that there's such an emphasis on prestige, or that there's certain career paths that are going to be more lucrative than others. They're in a lot of states, given just insurance requirements, nurse practitioners or PAs make more than primary care physicians. And this is not me, again, bashing the medical profession, right, but the salaries speak for themselves. And if that's the metric that we use to define success, which I personally don't subscribe to, but I think it's just important for people to understand that you could, there's a lot of flexibility with becoming a healthcare provider. It doesn't have to be a medical doctor, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And so we have to really be a lot more flexible. I think when people think about college, I guess this is a long-winded way of me saying that I think a lot of parents, out of fear for their children being left behind, are very rigid in their thought process. And I think that this process rewards being flexible and creative.
Will you provide some examples for the parents who, as to what they can do, how they can support their child's development in a balanced health way? And I should add, realistic, because another thing that I find with college and careers is that it's just unrealistic.
Yes, and I'm so glad you used the word realistic or unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And I would say with that, I would say at a very early age, like when we start to have conversations about college, I think the conversations need to be focused on how does an education fit with a long-term path? It's not where do you want to go to college, mm-hmm. but maybe phrasing the question of how is college going to help you achieve your long-term goal? So the question really needs to be, what is your long-term goal? And if you don't know it, how can I help you go achieve it? Do I need to, you know, help you sign up for a community college class so you can take an intro to business, an intro to public health, mm-hmm. an intro to engineering class? Would you like to see who do I know within, say, my house of worship community or within the community at large? That do we know a teacher, a lawyer, a dentist, so you could talk to them? Is like, let's get them mm-hmm. exposed to different mm-hmm. things, and let's start playing the long game. I ask students when I meet them, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Before, where would you like to go to college? Because I think that question needs to be prioritized. And so that would be my recommendation to any parent listening to this today, is lead with that question, and the follow-ups need to work towards that answer rather than mm-hmm. how do we get you into a certain name university here.
You know, students are going to face challenges. They need to be aware that that's just part of living in today's world. But what are some of the largest or biggest challenges that you would identify that students will face today? And how can they prepare to overcome them? What are
the biggest challenge facing young people today is the cost of their higher education. Okay. So I think we need to have very honest conversations starting at the beginning of high school, of what's within the family budget and what is the expectation for paying for college. I personally believe that a higher education should not saddle a young person with insurmountable student loans that can never be repaid, but that is the society that we live in. It is rather unique in the United States. And not to say Europe or Canada, but we need to have conversations about what makes sense. And if the only thing that makes sense is starting at a junior college and transferring to 4 years, that's okay, because it matters where you end up, not where you start. And so if we need to have conversation about what makes sense so young people can understand and have an understanding of what does it mean to have student loans? What does it mean if mom and dad are going to take on the loans mm-hmm. for when they retire, and what that obligation is going to be with young people? When it came time for when I was applying to college, I don't think I had a strong enough understanding of would I have money to go to grad school and what that would look like and what that path would look like. And so I think it's really, really important to have those conversations early so young people can understand finances and start making a plan.
I am talking with Greg Kaplan. He is the author of The Journey, How to Prepare Kids for a Competitive and Changing World. How would you describe your book? What distinguishes your book from other books out there? Because there's a myriad of books on college admission.
I would say that this book, there are a ton of books mm-hmm. out there about college admission, but I think that with this, I was very intentional about writing something that would frame college admission on in the perspective that it is one step on a much longer and more important path? And how do you develop skills and perspective that are needed to excel in college admissions, but also to develop skills that are more important for that where do you see yourself in 10-year question? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what separates the journey from the other books out there. And that I was trying to be very intentional about that. I'm not saying that others don't do that, but that is really the emphasis of mine. And because that is in my heart of hearts, what I truly believe.
Where can one purchase your book for my listening audience?
I would say wherever books are sold, which online I believe is Amazon and Barnes and Nobles. I'm hoping, I know there is distribution to independent bookstores and I really do want to promote them, but I would say probably the easiest places to find it would be on Amazon or Barnes and Noble.
What do you, I got all these questions, a million that I want to fire at you, but how do you suggest that students deal with failure and setbacks? Because they are going to encounter them.
You learn from them. Embrace them. As you learn, life doesn't reward you from reaching your goal on the first try. Life rewards you for picking yourself back up, asking yourself, how can I do better the next time? And then learning from that. So we cannot be afraid of challenge. We cannot be afraid of setback. We have to embrace it as part of a larger journey that equips us with the skills and perspective that we need to reach whatever destination we're seeking.
Okay. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I am talking with Greg Kaplan, and we are looking at getting into college. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you and continue our conversation on getting into college.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Let's look at getting into college. Planning for college can be one of the most exciting times in a young person's life. They are moving into the next level, a novel phase of life. But the whole college admission process can be an arduous task. It can be tiring and confusing and exhilarating and exhausting all in one breath. I'm talking with Greg Kaplan, college admission strategist. Greg, how do you, or what lessons can my listeners learn just from our conversation? What would you want them to take away?
I hope they take away from our conversation that this process of applying to college and thinking about one's career is what you make it. And that as long as they're willing to be flexible, open-minded, and realistic with what is achievable and what it takes to get to where they want to go and how that they need to develop the skills and perspective to reach their goals rather than accumulate fancy names or titles, that they will be equipped with the skills and perspective to make the most of every opportunity. And yes, this process is daunting. Yes, college education is extremely expensive today. But if you make it work for you, you will make the most of it. And because it's going to work for you. And that's really what this process rewards. So I hope that everyone listening to our conversation today recognizes that and holds that true to themselves.
Well, the trials and tribulations of college admission involve a roller coaster of emotional highs and lows, and they're felt throughout the process. Does the process have to be as stressful as it is?
No, it doesn't. This process, if you have a plan, and if you have a plan and stick to it and recognize that getting into Stanford is one thing, but maybe applying to, I'm going to use an example, like the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa is a completely different process and both could potentially lead to the same outcomes, then I think you realize like it's just about giving it your best shot. And so as long as you take that mindset of I can only put more opportunities on the board, then I think you realize it's like, okay, let's see what I can do. And that actually becomes quite empowering. And so I think if you're, if it's not, I have to get into, call it insert X name fancy school here, you're going to be fine. And I have had students, including ones I've met with very recently, that I don't think realized that, you know, that, you know, if you have fun and do things that are like unique to you as a student, I had a student who ended up getting into an Ivy League university who wrote about his experience of working at a restaurant and trying to understand patterns in ordering as related to cultural preferences in Southern California. This is someone who's going to an Ivy in the fall and wrote about taking orders at a taco stand near the beach. And I just think, and I use that story as an example because I think there's such pressure for young people today to find a cure for cancer. Would be lovely if they do for a lot of people, but it's not necessarily needed.
What are the common mistakes that are made on applications from your perspective?
I would say the most common mistake that I see is that there are a lot of folks who think that you have to play a sport to be admitted into a university or that sports are the path to a university. 6% of high school athletes today are recruited to play a sport, and then only 2% of high school athletes are awarded a scholarship. So I think that's a big misconception. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to high school, there is such an obsession with taking as many AP or college level classes as humanly possible. But for students who take these classes, there is an expectation that you're still going to get an A in them. So it's really important for young people to take the healthy amount of APs to make sure that they are doing well. And I went to the University of Pennsylvania for undergrad, and that is an Ivy, and I took 4 classes a semester. So I wholeheartedly reject the notion that someone who is 15 or 16 years old who are doing a variety of different activities is taking 5 or 6 college level classes. It's not healthy. But I hear it all the time that my child's in 5 AP classes. Why aren't they getting into Harvard? And I was like, but that's not what they're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Let me ask you, what are your thoughts on the SAT and the ACT? And it seems like we've gone full circle. I mean, when I was going to school, everybody had to take it. You probably took both of them, okay? But many schools just, in the last 10 years, 15 years, kind of dropped the requirement. And now we are returning. We're finding that schools are getting back to that. What are your thoughts on it? I mean, does DEI have an impact on this reversal, in your opinion?
You know what? So we got rid of the SAT and ACT in the state of California for the University of California and California State University systems. And these include some of the most sought after public universities in the country, UCLA, UC Berkeley, California Polytechnic, San Luis Obispo. And there were a lot of arguments raised about that these tests were racist because communities that are historically underrepresented from higher ed tend to score lower. But when you look into the data, I wouldn't say that these tests, there is a, you know, on the basis of background, but I do think there's a certain classism element in it because students that have access to high quality tutors to prepare for these tests do better. So what you see actually are in affluent communities, test scores being higher because there's more time and resources to study for them. And so there have been arguments on both sides saying that including the test scores or not including test scores have led to an increase in diversity or decrease in diversity. Mm-hmm. What I want to tell everyone listening is that it's not so much what we think about the test, but the fact of the matter is that if you are interested in applying to one of these selective universities, mostly Ivy League requires it today. But what the results have shown is that 75% of students admitted to selective universities submitted test scores. And if you're coming from a school or community where they know there's an emphasis placed on educational outcomes and the resources to achieve those outcomes, they do want to see a test score. Mm-hmm. And so when I tell students that are applying from communities where that describes where they're coming from, that they should study for the test because there's that expectation. So I think that, you know, there are students that it is just not feasible to study for the test because of family constraints or obligations or financial limitations. That's okay. But if that doesn't apply to you, treat this test as an opportunity to develop the skills to excel at a standardized test, because that is an important skill. And there's no shame in saying that. I don't think these tests are IQ or intelligence tests, but they do. They are a common yardstick that make it easy from a data perspective to know if someone's meets whatever, you know, threshold of criteria of scores and tests that will help them get in. So treat it as an opportunity, not as an obstacle. Okay. And if it's just impossible to study because of the way I framed it, that's okay. But for people where that doesn't apply to them, they need to embrace that those are the students from backgrounds where that it's okay not to have a test score. So I think that's a little more inclusive. I think it says, again, a lot about society. If that does align with certain underrepresented groups in education, that's a conversation for another day of why is there that overlap between resources and then a lack of DEI. But I think that there are a lot of folks, regardless of what their background is, that this test would be an opportunity. And that's why I want to emphasize the positivity of it.
How does one, these last few minutes, we don't have much, but how does one identify their unique talents and then communicate them in the application?
I would say it comes down into the essays.
Okay.
So if your numbers meet the threshold, then they're going to open up your application and they're going to read the essays and the activity descriptions. And the way you get to make the case for admission is through your writing. Mm-hmm. And what these admissions officers want to understand isn't necessarily what you did, because a student growing up, say, in Manhattan may have access to different opportunities than a kid growing up in where my mom is from, for example, rural North Dakota. It's very different life experiences. But how did you learn? How did you grow? What did you learn from those experiences? And that growth is what matters. Again, I go back to the example of my student who worked at a taco stand, who wrote about observing trends in which types of people from which parts of the country on vacation ordered what food items, and is interested in studying that at a larger level. I think that is quite profound. And I've had students who have written more about being in a lab and doing research and just thinking that the research was what was important, but what did you learn about the scientific process? How does that matter and to you? Is so much more important than I'm working on the cure for cancer. So I always tell students, it's not what you do, but it's what you learn from it. And there are learning lessons in every part of life. And what you learned from those experiences, no matter how mundane, are what will propel you to success in this process.
What role do you advise parents play in this whole process?
I would say, I'm so glad you asked that question, Liz, because I think that's, I wish more people would ask themselves that and ask of others. I would say it is someone who is the greatest cheerleader, someone who can help row the boat and provide direction when needed, but most importantly, gives their child the space to figure out what makes them tick intrinsically. I literally was just, I right before our interview, I had a mother and a son, and this was a family that was contemplating moving 250 miles, uprooting everything to go to a fancy, fancy, fancy prep school. Mm. And it was, the conversation was like, I think you should do student government because that'll be a great way to show you're a leader. Not, how do you want to be a leader? Because I asked the young person this, and he said, well, I'd like to try to become team captain of my soccer team. And I was like, that's perfectly fine for me and perfectly fine for these college admissions officers. So taking yourself out of the equation, I guess that would be the way I would sum it up.
Okay. Because the student, I feel, correct me, I could be wrong, but I feel like the student should be in control.
110%.
Okay.
The student needs to be, because if it doesn't come from within, if it doesn't come from within, it will not come at all. Mm-hmm. And
suggestions, excuse me, for just give them some suggestions as to how this student exercises control.
I would say an example of a way a student exercises control would be, I'm interested in, for example, if a student says they're interested in something engineering related, saying, would you like to try something maybe like robotics? Would you like to take a community college class on intro to engineering? Would you like to see if you'd like to talk to someone down the street that works as an engineer? Mm-hmm. Not demanding anything of them, but working with them to brainstorm ideas and letting the young person pick and saying, I don't care what you do, but you do have to do something. You do need to be making progress. Mm-hmm. And I think that is giving them the choice to make progress, where they have the agency and the control of the situation, even if you're inspiring them, because they may not know these things exist, but working with them to find those opportunities.
As a counselor, they would need to create, I think they need to advise a student to create a platform for lifetime success. And do you have suggestions as to how to do that? How do you advise them that, yes, we're here, but there is a tomorrow, and, you know, you're not always going to be in college, and we need to look at success. Like you say, where are you going to be 10 years from now? Do you have any suggestions as to how you can create a platform for that?
I would say it's being there and asking them questions, like, how do you feel about this? Like, do you see how this is going to help you with that tenure question? Like, do you mm-hmm. feel like this is making progress, even if you're stuck in the mud today? So you had a setback, you got a C in the class, or you tried something, you had an internship at a law firm and realized that you'd rather be picking up trash on the side of the road. That's fantastic. That's mm-hmm. one less thing we have to do. So I think it's more about, as young people transition from children to adults, is how do you make sure that they feel supported along the way? Because I think that platform, especially in a world that feels very competitive and hyper-challenging, as long as you know it's going to be okay mm-hmm. and that there's going to be false starts along the road, that foundation for success is going to look and feel different for every young person. But I think at the end of the day, we all feel a little better knowing that there's someone in our corner. And if that's not a family member, if you are listening as a young person, find those trusted adults that, and you don't have to necessarily be adults, but just mm-hmm. trusted people. Like find your tribe that is in your corner that can be a sounding board for you to develop the skills and the perspective needed to know what success is and define it on your own terms.
As I think about the pressures and the changes that both teens and parents endure, success is certainly influenced by one's ability to adapt and adjust. Do you have any closing remarks that you might make in regards to adapting and how important it is to be able to adapt?
Yes, and I think that's a great way to end any interview on this topic, is that this is my third, I take an example from my own life. Me becoming a college admissions advisor, this is my third career. But I would not have been successful in teaching young people how to pitch themselves had I not tried and hated being an investment banker, where I learned how to pitch the value one company could bring to another. And I don't think I would be as effective of teaching a young person how to write about themselves if I didn't learn how to write as a lawyer making an argument to a court. Mm-hmm. And so you don't need to become an investment banker, go to law school to be successful. But I look at those experiences and where I try to say, what can I learn from this, even if I don't want to do this anymore? Those are really important skills to learn. And we've had so many students we've worked with that have thought that they wanted to be engineers and get to university and realize that they're not cut out for it. But that scientific process, that problem solving that comes from studying engineering for however long it is, can be applicable to other areas of life. So maybe it's not about necessarily being just adaptable, but taking what we learn from uncomfortable situations and finding ways to apply it elsewhere in our lives. That is a gift. and there's no bad experiences out there. There are experiences we may never want to have again.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But there are lessons to be learned from everything in life, big and small, and we just have to remember them.
Well, it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. And Greg, I appreciate you so much. It has been a real joy to talk to you, maybe because we're on the same page, but thanks so much for sharing your expertise. To my listening audience, much appreciation for the privilege of your time and your ear. This is Dr. Liz Holyfield inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.